Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Hey!
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? My daddy was a miner, he's now in the air and sun. He'll be with you fellow workers until the battle's won. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? If you go up to Arlen County, there is no neutral there. You're either with the Union or thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Don't scab for the bosses. Don't listen to their lies. Us working folks don't have a chance unless we organize. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Welcome to the Wobbly Radio Show. We are sitting around the table, five of us fellow workers, and I am going to start it off to my left. Would you introduce yourself?
My name is Alan, and I'm on the left. I've been around for a while, and he and him are my choices, I guess.
Alrighty.
When did you join?
I don't remember. It's been so long. 71 or 72.
Okay, long time worker.
And I'm on Al's left. My name is Lynn, and I've been part of WOB Radio for a couple of years, I guess. WOB Radio, in case you're a new listener, it stands for Wobbly, and Wobbly is the term that's been used for 100 years for the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW. So anyway, I've been a member for a few years, and I was a member several years before that. So dual membership, I guess.
My name is fellow worker Gordon. I use he, him pronouns. I live in Bremerton, but I'm a proud member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the IWW. Been in the union since 2008. I'm a retired shipyard worker. Passing it along to...
My name is fellow worker Noah. I've been part of the Tacoma branch of the IWW since March of 2021. I'm kind of like the local producer here for WOB Radio. I do all the magic of editing and adjusting the audio and everything. And of course, I'm also a co-host with the rest of my fellow workers. And I am also the Tacoma branch secretary. I just recently got elected to that. So that's who we are.
Yay! And my name is fellow worker Marilyn. I've been a member since roughly 2008. I'm a delegate, so if you want to become a Wobbly, you can contact me on Facebook or through the website, and I would be glad to orient you and sign you up to be a fellow member.
I'm also a delegate as well. I'm branch secretary, but I also do delegate work. Anyways,
continue. That's Noah. And I want to just remind the listener that the Industrial Workers of the World, the word is world there. We are, I think, pretty much the only international union in the United States, because an injury to one is an injury to all.
Fellow worker Lynn is now going to read us a section of the preamble to the Constitution of the IWW to give you a little bit more context of who we are and what we're about.
The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things in life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. Finally, these conditions can be changed and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on any department thereof, thus making an injury to one, an injury to all.
Thank you, fellow worker Lynn. Jumping off into labor-related news today, does anyone have any articles that they would like to report on?
Oh, yeah, a very exciting historic victory in Tennessee. Apparently outside of Chattanooga. This was April 20th. Workers at Volkswagen's Tennessee plant have voted to join the UAW, United Auto Workers, in a seismic victory for the union as it drives beyond its Detroit base into the U.S. South and West.
Woohoo!
A majority of eligible workers cast ballots in favor of the union, or 73% approved joining the UAW. The landslide win will make the Chattanooga factory the first auto plant in the South to unionize via election since the 1940s and the first foreign-owned auto plant in the South to do so.
Solidarity.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that article was from Reuters, correct?
Yes.
Alrighty. Yes. Yeah, no, I think that's really, really cool because, you know, like you said, there hasn't really been a big auto workers campaign in the South for, I think, since the 30s or 40s, like
over,
you said.
Over 80 years.
Yeah, and what was really interesting about that campaign, too, is that shortly before the vote, there was, I believe it was the governor of Tennessee and a few other, like, southern governors and lower-level politicians were, like, trying to discourage the workers from organizing with the UAW. But despite all of that political pressure, they still decided to vote in favor of it anyway, so that's pretty big, especially for a more conservative part of the country as well.
Oh, yes.
It's very big.
Norma Rae would be proud.
Yeah.
Well, and then also you reminded me that some of the governors in some of those southern states, or even Midwest, are making it, they're changing their state's rules and laws so that people, like kids 14, can work in meatpacking plants and clean up the waste of animal slaughter.
It's dangerous work.
And, it's dangerous work, and they should be sleeping and going to school the next day. And it's terrible. I mean, they're undoing the child labor laws that protect children.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just another trend that the certain type of governors adopt.
They're building a bridge to the 19th century is what you're telling me.
I think something kind of tangential to that as well, especially for labor organizing in the South. Like you said, they're definitely repealing a lot of child labor laws as well, but actually in the state of, and if I'm remembering this correctly, I don't have the article in front of me, in the state of Florida, they actually made it so that any employer that voluntarily recognizes a union without an election, just says, I recognize you, let's begin negotiating, actually gets punished by the government now. I believe in the form of a fine or some other form of taxation for it. So they're actually putting in financial incentives against businesses who voluntarily recognize unions. That's how bad it's getting. Yeah. Any further notes on that? Any further conversation?
Just to note that the South has always been anti-union because they like to use their contract labor that comes out of the prisons and out of the work farms down South. So they've been anti-union just as sort of a matter of course over the decades, and they're being forced to change their tune because the workers are standing up.
And a lot of the workers, I think, have been trained not to, in the past, not to understand about unions, and they've been taught that it's communism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much Red Scare tactics, especially now that a bunch of the labor unions are also coming out in support of Palestine as well.
Right.
Without the permission of the AFL-CIA.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. They've definitely been kind of holding back on that, although the UAW and a few other major trade unions have spoken out in favor of ceasing arms sales and material aid to Israel, which is actually pretty cool. Gordon, you had an article about Boeing locking out their firefighters?
That's right. We have breaking news, as a matter of fact. I hate to say that, but it's true. A few days ago, on the 1st of May, the union was notified that Boeing was ceasing negotiations with the IAFF local I-66, which is a firefighters union. And this kind of surprised me that Boeing is not negotiating with their frontline safety workers in the midst of a safety crisis and practically a safety stand down, because, you know, wheels keep falling off Boeing planes, and so they're going to fix it by, you know, locking out the firefighters. Now, for those who are listening who don't know what a lockout is, picture it's a reverse strike. The management gets the hint that things are going on the shop floor, and their spies tell them there's a bunch of, you know, outside agitators. So what they do is they preemptively lock the workers out so that they can't come to work, and so they can't, you know, go on strike, essentially.
You can't go fight fires.
Yes, you can't fight fires. And the thing is that when I think of firefighters, I always think of a local municipal or county or city government. However, I should have known. I worked in the shipyard in Bremerton for over 30 years, and we had our own fire department with two fire stations. Because it was a heavy industrial facility, they frequently fought fires aboard ship, and it was necessary. But they weren't. They were federal employees. Well, it made sense to me after I read about Boeing that a large industrial facility like that would have its own fire department.
One of the things those firefighters do is every time they put fuel into a plane that doesn't take it off yet, there are firefighters standing around making sure nothing goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, they're well trained as first responders, EMTs. There's hundreds of call-outs for medical assistance on the floor.
Yeah.
And it's the firefighters that put them in the ambulance and take them home, or take them to the hospital, rather.
Well, anyway, Boeing doesn't think much of their ability to untarnish the company's reputation, because they're locking them out, and that's supposed to happen today, I believe.
Yeah.
The deadline is today. Go ahead.
So then some major fire breaks out, and they're all, you know, doing their own thing because they're not supposed to be at work. And it's like, that's going to really reflect well on Boeing, isn't it, when a bunch of people get hurt or equipment gets really
ruined.
Damaged.
I would also probably add that the firefighters specifically of this union that work on airfields are probably trained similar to obviously firefighters from a municipality, but I imagine they're also trained to deal with more high-risk situations. They're working around a lot of, you know, large-size industrial equipment. You know, airplanes are very large vehicles. They carry a lot of fuel, so the hazards there, if something goes badly, is slightly higher than probably responding to a house fire. You're potentially dealing with, like, an explosion. So it is very, very concerning that Boeing in this labor dispute has decided to lock them out entirely,
mm-hmm.
because it's putting potentially thousands of people at risk as long as the flights continue to go.
Yeah, and they're probably specialized. They probably get a lot of their employees, their firefighters, from the ranks of military who have been trained to use that nasty foam to put out airplane fires. and so that's a specialized training, and they're well worth the wage package that they're looking for. Yeah, they said 12:01 today. We're recording on Saturday, May 4th. That's exactly 60 days after more than 80% of the members of the International Association of Firefighters, IAFF, Local I-66, rejected the company's final contract offer for the first time. The firefighters voted to reject the offer again last month. So what's going on here is typical corporate, you know, hardball plan. They're looking at these firefighters as uppity employees. They're not looking at them as integral to the function of the company, and also for their tarnished image. I mean, let's face it, panels falling off of airplanes, you know, people sitting in the cabin with the side of the airplane gone. So another interesting thing about IAFF is that one would think, you know, firefighters are kind of lumped in together with police and sheriff's deputies, sort of as the same family. They might be in the same kind of situation and also equal or greater risk, but they're a different mindset than a police agency. Firefighters actually want to protect lives and property. They want to protect your house. They want to protect your kids, and they're specially trained. And so this is what gets to me, that an outfit that really protects the company's reputation is being locked out of, and so everybody else is supposed to keep working. If I was one of the workers on the floor, I would think very heavily about not doing that. So that's what's happening today. They had some informational pickets going, which sort of, you know, you could argue that kind of shows your hand as far as a worker. The company got wind, and so that's why they decided to go for this draconian lockout. There's a quote from one of the union leaders. If we're going to make history, there's no better time than now. This is a guy named Mr. Yeager. If Boeing can afford to pay one disgraced CEO $33 million during a safety crisis, it can afford to pay our firefighters enough to live a middle-class lifestyle. So that's about it for this report. It's ongoing. It's strange to think, you know, and it could be spun as, oh, they're abandoning all these workers to danger, but that's not the case. Anybody who works in a large industrial facility and works alongside firefighters and EMTs and medics and that kind of personnel knows how essential they are. I was with a guy who had a heart attack down below decks in one of the engine rooms on an aircraft carrier. And so how in the hell are we going to get this guy out? The firefighters knew exactly what to do. And they worked closely with the riggers who dropped in a gurney and everything. We got the guy out and his life was saved. So that's the end of my pontification about safety and firefighters. But you can go on the IAFF website or Facebook page and you can find out what you can do if you live near any of the facilities. You can find out what you can do to support those locked out firefighters.
Thank you, fellow worker Gordon.
Thank you.
I wouldn't be surprised, but some of them are on duty just because their conscience would have them be there.
It happens, but...
But they're locked out.
They're locked out.
I imagine it's a similar situation to hospital staff, where even if nurses and other staff at a hospital go out on strike, I imagine that there's an agreement that some of them stay behind, because obviously sure. You can't have a bunch of sick patients with nobody tending to them,
That's
but you can
right.
still have a portion of the majority of the workforce go out on strike.
And skeleton crew. Well, that harkens back to the general strike in Seattle and Tacoma back in 1919, mm-hmm. where the workers' committee that organized this total general strike said, okay, we're going to make an exception. For whom? For emergency workers and for milk truck drivers, mm-hmm. because they were bringing milk to the babies. Mm-hmm. And so I bet you a lot of mothers got the ear of the union leadership and said, you can't do that. We got to have these milk trucks come.
Our kids still need to eat.
That's right. But they cooperated. And who decided that was the council, the strike committee.
If we recall, President Biden did a photo op with the United Auto Workers. He put on the baseball cap and he walked by the guys, standing around. Mm-hmm. And the press said, well, he's the most labor-positive president we've ever had. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then a week later... when the railroad workers wanted to, what did they want?
They wanted more than one person on a train.
Wanted more than one sick day, if that.
And what was Biden's response to this? This one.
Shut them down.
Yep.
Over 100,000 workers were threatened with jail.
Right.
The most labor-friendly president we've ever had.
So moving on in our radio show today, we are going to go ahead and stop by and do a little book review. This is fellow worker Noah doing the book review for this episode for May. Or I remembered a children's book of mine that I actually grew up reading called Click Clack Moo, Cows That Type. It's a very, very cute book written by Doreen Cronin and illustrated by Betsy Lewin. I remember reading this when I was in elementary school, and the illustration and the story itself are both very cute. It's very approachable for a lot of younger children especially. But the cool thing about this children's book is that it has a very pro-collective action, almost blatantly union message without saying the U word. And I thought it would be a great recommendation, especially since it's May. We just recently came by May Day. I think this is a good starting off point for talking to your children about what is a union? What is collective action? How can you and your other fellow workers or other fellow kids, you know, collaborate with each other in order to get better things out of your future employers? So, just to give a brief summary of the story here, there's a farmer who has a farm, and the cows at his farm stumble across a typewriter, and they start typing on the typewriter, and the farmer who owns the farm keeps hearing them typing all days all of the hours of the day and night. And one day he finds a note posted to the front of his barn that basically says, "We are the cows. It is very cold at night. We would like electric blankets." And Farmer Brown responded strictly no. So the cows refuse to give their milk. And this actually spreads on to the other farmyard animals as well, seeing that the cows have this collective action working to their benefit. The cows are refusing to give milk. Farmer Brown won't give the electric blankets. So the strike continues. Eventually, the chickens get the word that they also, too, can work together with the cows collectively in order to get better for their working conditions.
Look out for them chickens. They can get rowdy.
So the chickens and the cows collaborate, and the chickens say, if the cows aren't going to give milk, and if you won't listen to their demands, then we're not going to give you eggs, farmer. So the farmer is furious and finally resorts to going to his typewriter. And he hires one of his farm's ducks in order to deliver the message as an intermediator.
Scab.
Farmer Brown responds to all the farmyard animals and basically says, "I'll give you the electric blankets you want. Can you please just give me the milk and eggs back? I'm willing to negotiate with you on this." And so the cows and the chickens finally get their electric blankets so that they can stay warm at night. Farmer Brown finally gets his milk and eggs again. But then the ducks at the barn, who were previously the intermediaries between the farmer and the other farmyard animals, get the typewriter for themselves and start making their demands. And the cycle continues. So it's a very, very cute, very well illustrated children's book. And I'm surprised that I read it as a kid and the message didn't really click with me until I rediscovered it just late last month. We recently had a branch member who has a younger daughter, about 2 years old now, I believe, who just had her birthday back in March. So we got her this book as a birthday gift as part of our union branch here in Tacoma. I think it's really cool. I think that it's a great way to kind of, like I said, introduce your kids to the whole concept of things like collective action and being willing to work together with others for a common good and a common goal. And I think it's, like I said, the most pro-union children's book without ever dropping the U word. And I think if you want to educate your kids about that, this is a good place to start.
And who publishes it?
This is published by... This is the Spanish translation because this fellow union member is Spanish-speaking. This was published by Lectorum Publications. The original publisher was Simon & Schuster Children's Publishing Division in New York.
Okay. So if somebody's interested in getting that for their spring offs...
Not to sound like a huge hypocrite, but I did order this off of Amazon, but please buy directly from the publisher when you can. I bought this as kind of a last minute thing, and I'm like, I'm going to have to give Jeff Bezos some money. Yeah, no, I think it's a great children's book, and like I said, it's really well illustrated, and it's very approachable, and...
Interesting to note that you got the Spanish version, thinking of our fellow worker and his child, in keeping them in mind, and also, I would think, if it's been translated into Spanish, it could be other translations, so... Write to the publisher, and they might have a German or Vietnamese or whatever Russian translation.
That's
of the
book. A good point.
Well, the early teaching the value of sharing and cooperating for what you want and what is good for the group is great, because when you get into preschool and kindergarten, if you don't have those skills understood, if not in action, it's just a lot harder for you and your family to go through your early years, at least. And so anything that can kind of ease them into correct thinking as far as, you know, thinking of our fellow people, our fellow workers, our fellow classmates. Great message.
Yeah. And I mean, I think something that this book also made me think of, too, is that we often think of things like unions or collective action or thing or other related activities as being very adult-oriented, but there have been plenty of other youth movements who have taken on as part of their... collective act, things like collective action or even pro-union support, youth organizations have been very much supportive of as well, both in the past and in the present. I think for the future, it would be really cool to collaborate and somehow form like a labor library, maybe here in Tacoma, so that younger people can have access to that kind of literature and that kind of education. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I highly recommend the book. Again, the title is Click Clack Moo, Cows That Type. It is written by Doreen Cronin and illustrated by Betsy Lewin out of Simon & Schuster Publishing. And they also have other language translations as well.
Hello, fellow workers and listeners. I'm going to give a couple of very brief announcements about that wonderful world that lies over the Narrows Bridge. Kitsap County and Bremerton, gateway to Aberdeen. But anyway, we're trying to start a IWW branch out that way, and we have a couple of activities that have been going on. I'm sorry that today I can't attend the first annual Kitsap Anarchist Book Fair, which is the AKAB, if that means anything to y'all. And which is it's just the first time they're having one out in Kitsap. A lot of people are coming in from west of us that are sort of unaffiliated wobblies and unaffiliated anarchist type people. They're going to have a couple of activities coming up. I have an email address if you'd like to email them, but here we go. I'm trying to find. There we go. So I asked if the book fair would be over by the time we got out of our broadcast meeting today, and yes, it will be. But there's a show at the Charleston this evening. The Charleston Theater, which is on Callow Avenue. As soon as you come into town, just keep following the signage, going drifting right, and go into town, and is right on the main drag headed toward Kitsap Way. It's a block from Kitsap Way.
That's in Bremerton?
That's in Bremerton, okay. Washington. And it's a good venue. They used to have a lot of punk concerts there, but now it's expanded. The Wobblies out there had a film night, and it's an all-ages bar, so you can, you know, if you sit in the right section, you can have a hard pop. And the underage kids can have a good time partying down on the floor in the mosh pit or up in the gallery with the old folks. So fellow worker Kit has asked me to share an announcement that our next movie night will be, and talking about children's books and children's literature, the movie is going to be Fern Gully at the Charleston on June 20th.
I love that movie.
Yeah, I figured you would. I mean, you're the guy who reads children's books. But anyway, it's a good thing for the community. It's a good thing that we're having some kid-friendly events. We had a sort of a picnic-like play day event last September. And there's an email address, and it's all lowercase. And if you want to find out what's going on out in Kitsap County, either wobbly-wise or other activities, all lowercase, kitsapiww@proton.me. And also, we've been working on May Day. I went and waved my red and black flag, standing with the local DSA members out there in Bremerton. And we're starting to have a good cross-pollination between DSA and IWW.
Good.
I know the Tacoma branch has a couple of close contacts with DSA. We don't always agree 100% on everything, but we're in solidarity with one another. So I enjoy that, you know, we're reaching out in that community. So that's all I got. Yep, that's it for Kitsap events.
Alrighty. Thank you, fellow worker Gordon. Moving forward, we have our first roundtable of the episode today, and since this is kind of a May Day edition, we're hoping to pack in as much informative content for our fellow listeners as possible from a working class perspective. Our first roundtable today, we were going to be talking about intergenerational activism, avoiding ageism in community and workplace organizing, and youth and elderly empowerment, dual empowerment. Would anyone like to kick off this discussion?
Wow. That's a mouthful, and it kind of blends in with the next thing. So it's sort of like one big, huge discussion. Some things are obvious when you look at intergenerational activism, and I don't want to insult the listener by repeating the obvious, but in case you haven't really gotten involved or looked at it, what I see personally, and this is my opinion, I see young people with the energy, the sophisticated technical education, and the idealism and enthusiasm to carry activism forward. And that's wonderful. And I see older people with, if their memories are intact, the experience, both negative and positive, to be able to guide and help some of the younger people in a way that they can avoid some of the pitfalls that we had to learn the hard way.
And in ways that they can accept or help.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
And plus, if we're lucky enough to have some bucks, we can kick money into it too. So resources and experience we may not be able to march on a extended walk because our bodies are falling apart, but we've got the cars to be able to transport people, and we've got the money to be able, hopefully we have the money to be able to contribute.
Yes. Fellow worker Marilyn, how would you characterize that term, ageism? And maybe you could give a couple of specific examples of it.
Well, I'd be glad to, but I want more people to pipe in too, because I don't have all the answers. What I see is, from the older point of view here, because I'm old, I'm 76, quite often I find myself at sea when it comes to accessing some of the computer links and things like that. Like, you know, first there was regular, then there was Signal, there's Facebook, there's all these
Discord,
all these different platforms that I have trouble negotiating. And it's hard to ask for help, but then when you ask for help, sometimes people don't explain it in a way that is helpful. They'll do it for you, but they won't explain how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like the old saw about give somebody a fishing pole and they can fish. So that's one example of ways that sometimes older people are marginalized. Another way is that sometimes an older person can feel shoved aside and ignored. And that happens and it hurts. And I'm not quite sure how to redirect that phenomenon.
Hmm.
Now, I haven't had that so much in the IWW. And I'm not going to name organizations that are kind of famous for doing that. But I've certainly experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody else at the table experienced that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just recently. I've recently entered the ranks of old people. So I have felt it, and I have witnessed it, and I've also seen it go the other way. Ageism can be older people shutting off or shutting out young people.
Huh.
It can work both ways, but what I've noticed, of course, is
look at our presidential races right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Octogenarians versus octogenarians.
Yeah. Right.
The younger voters, what they need to vote for.
Yeah.
John Stewart had a funny thing about that the other night.
Yeah.
Mm. What did he have?
He said that Biden and Trump represent by far the oldest presidential candidates we've ever had, beaten only by the record set 4 years ago by them.
They true. Beat their own record in the same election that we're having again between them.
Mm. Well, it does show that there could be a bias.
Well, I guess from a younger fellow worker's perspective, I have definitely witnessed that kind of ageism specifically directed towards, like Marilyn said, not so much toward within the IWW. We do try and be as mindful about that as possible. Obviously, we have something like a safer spaces policy. Mm-hmm. I've also talked to members of different branches who specifically have a fellow worker at branch meetings or committee meetings and stuff like that, who act as kind of the safer spaces policy mediator, so that whenever something does happen, you know, whether there's some kind of microaggression or unintentional misgendering or something like that, they can then talk to that person later and just be like, hey, I love you, but we do need to talk about this thing that happened. We do have fellow workers who are definitely good about that. But I think the broader point that I would like to make is, it kind of, like all things in the IWW, it kind of has to be a collective intent on making sure that that doesn't happen. Having a safer spaces policy mediator or enforcer, in quotation marks, I know that that's not a huge, very popular word in the union, but to have somebody that can at least, at the very least, keep an eye on those
observer.
Policies. Yeah, observer, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, we do not need to kind of, it has to be a collective concerted effort. There can't just be one person doing it all the time, because even that person might have biases or oversights that they might not be able to see.
Right.
Everybody has to do it all the time. Yeah.
And part of, I think for me, what blends into this is, as an older woman, our society just Ooh. Kind of makes us invisible.
Yes.
So I'm duly sensitive to that.
Right.
And it's different from most societies, most cultures in the world.
Right. There are matriarchal societies where older women actually do have a lot more social and cultural capital over things that happen in community. Yeah.
Well, more traditionally than modernly, but basically older people in many cultures were revered. And mm-hmm. so, if not revered, really respected, you know, maybe above all other generations, but that's just so mm-hmm. different here with the population being so dispersed, et cetera.
I think you'll find that in the indigenous community in this country, the elders are the respected ones, and it's the grandmas who really are pulling the strings behind the scenes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The guys are going to do what they're going to do, and then they're going to get that look, and they're going to change their mind, and whatever, yes, dear, whatever you say, as long as it's good for us, and it's good for the children as well.
Yeah. It reminds me of that one saying, you know, men like to think they're the head of everything, but it's the women who turn the neck. Yeah.
Well, and I don't need to be revered. I just want equality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And we offer different things, and that's what makes the wheel go around, Noah.
I was actually going to touch on that. I really like that you made that point earlier, and I think we even discussed it on several episodes ago, mm-hmm. that when it comes to collective action in a workplace, or whether that's community organizing or something like that, you know, it's good to recognize the benefit, different kinds of skills and benefits that people can bring to the table. Like you said, you know, older people might not have the availability of energy in all cases, but they do have access to resources, or especially life experience mm-hmm. in regards to activism or workplace organizing and other related activities.
Survival,
yeah. They have a lot more experience with that and do pass on very valued information towards younger fellow workers. Yes, Gordon?
What are the fellow workers at the table, what are your ideas about how to tell somebody whom you believe is exercising some kind of bias or prejudice against, whether you're older or younger, how do we, in a comradely way, confront that?
I do have a suggestion, and I've actually had to do this a few times before, not specifically within the union, but in other parts of my life as well, where if you do want to confront someone about, like, microaggressions or misgendering or ageism, it's always good to highlight the fact that you're trying to help someone with their behavior, not who they are as a person. They're not a bad person. It's just they're exhibiting or expressing behaviors or attitudes that aren't good for in-group cohesion and inclusivity. Mm-hmm. So I've definitely had conversations with other people where it's like, hey, you know, I don't think you recognize it, and I don't think you're a bad person because you did it. But, for example, you have said something recently that might come off as homophobic or might come off as transphobic, something
right.
like that.
And they don't mean it. They
right.
don't intend to.
They don't
to.
Mean it. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, it's different in real-world spaces versus online spaces, where sometimes people act like an idiot intentionally to troll you and waste your time and your energy. Whereas I feel like a lot of real-world interactions, you can have that connection with people and kind of be like, again, I know that you had no intent with this. I can tell that you have no intent with this, but this is going to be problematic if it continues. Mm. So why don't we talk about why this happened and how I can potentially change your perspective on that?
That's brave on your part.
You have to come to it in love.
Gordon.
To elaborate on that just a little bit, I had to be schooled during the course of my life about inadvertent racism and inadvertent misogyny or misogynist type remarks. I had to be schooled. So the key is to be willing to be schooled, to be willing to have a person share with you their concerns. Culture changes constantly. And
good point.
Well, it's constantly, you know, what was appropriate in our day is not appropriate for Noah's day, and maybe not appropriate for somebody even younger than Noah, if anybody on the planet exists that's younger than Noah.
Gen Alpha, I believe they're called. I'm not kidding.
Rockelita.
Yeah,
that's the only one I know. But anyway, what I'm getting at is that it's that willingness to understand. And you don't get a person to understand by backing them into a corner or her into a corner and yelling at them or embarrassing them or making them feel like hell.
Which leads me to want to pick out a few things that are specifics. If you want to get through to a person and actually communicate, you don't really want to confront them in public. It's much better if you speak to them one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, you don't want to go to the authorities. You want to speak to that person directly as a first step.
Right.
You know, rather than jumping those hoops and making a big deal out of it. From a psychological perspective, because I was a therapist for years and years, it's also good if you personally were wounded by something to use I feel statements. Because nobody can argue with how you feel. So I'm going to use a fake example.
Okay.
Say I'm sitting in a meeting and I'm expressing a point of view briefly, not going on and on. And I see a young person across the table maybe roll their eyes and smirk at somebody else. Okay, that doesn't feel good to me. That feels kind of disrespectful. What I could do is go to that person directly and say, Alberto, I felt discounted and disrespected when I was speaking and you rolled your eyes at me. Did you mean for me to feel that way?
Wow.
Hmm.
And that gets right to the point.
Hmm. That's like the opposite of confrontational.
Yeah. Well,
that's the idea. I know. I'm getting it.
Yeah. Yeah, because then you get right to the point of it. They can't argue with how you felt.
Right.
If you say, I thought you were disrespectful.
That's
completely different.
I understand. That's good. So it's a statement of your feelings and broaching the topic that way.
And kind of touching on what I said previously, you're addressing directly the behavior and how it made you felt, rather than saying either objectively or, like you said, from a perspective of, I thought you did something disrespectful to me, that they could potentially blow off if they were trying to be disrespectful to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think another situation where you could... I think another example of this would probably be something along the lines of, especially with language, I know that a lot of terms that have previously been used to describe, for example, marginalized communities have definitely changed over the years.
Oh, yeah.
Language is something that is always in flux. Common definitions always change at least two or three times a generation. So I think when it comes
makes
to...
Makes me want to say, that's sick.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Don't do that.
I can only imagine the Merriam-Webster... I can only imagine that the staff at Merriam-Webster have become more busy over the past two or three decades as the internet has expanded and that effect on language, but that's a whole other discussion. But I think from the perspective of addressing, instead of behavior, maybe language, you could say something along the lines of, I know you didn't mean any disrespect towards this person or this community, but I would like to let you know that that term is no longer considered appropriate or in vogue by that community. Instead, they prefer X. For example, I follow a lot of trans YouTubers and trans content creators online who are also involved a lot in leftist spaces and organizing. And they have touched on the fact that while there are some older trans people who prefer the term transsexual because that was the term that was commonly used and accepted at the time, nowadays, the more common and appropriate term of transgender is used because they describe two different things within that specific community, or because transgender is the more preferred term used by the community rather than transsexual as it used to be. So again, for the example, it would be, hey, I know that you referred to this person as transsexual, but the more common and appropriate term that most trans people like to use nowadays is transgender. That would be another example. Yeah.
So just saying trans, does that just skirt the whole thing?
Trans is also another really good, I guess, how do I want to put this? Trans is also another appropriate term used by the transgender community as well, just as kind of the shortened version of the word. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Again, it's not about trying to get someone in trouble, and you also made this point as well. It's not trying to make someone feel belittled that they might have done something that could be considered offensive. It's about coming to them in love and saying, hey, I'm not sure if you intended this, but I felt blank because you did blank.
So before we leave this topic and move on to the next, most but not everything that I've learned in my life has come from my elders. And every once in a while, there's some young person's got a good idea too that I pay attention to. But let's just leave it with this. Maya Angelou is a poet. And she once said, if you don't know where you've come from, you don't know where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're quite through with this subject yet, because us old people around the table have had our say. But Noah, you being our representative young person, I want to hear what you've got to say about reverse ageism, which you experience from older people sometimes, that is troubling.
If you did.
On that point, especially in the union spaces that I'm commonly in, or in the leftist spaces that I'm commonly in, I don't really get that kind of reverse ageism experience because, again, we are a little bit more woke about that fact that we should be inclusive to intergenerational cooperation and organization and things mm-hmm. like that. I've never really encountered that terribly much. I will say, and this is kind of more like a self-call-out, I will say that especially in regards to technology or adaptability or accessibility for older generations that you might be organizing with, be more proactive about that. For example, you mentioned earlier things like Jitsi, which we use for our branch meetings, or Discord, or even Audacity, which is what I use to mm-hmm. record this radio show. I know that myself and younger fellow workers should probably be more mindful of, hey, there are older fellow workers who want to know how to use this and want to have this be accessible to them. You have to put in the time and, yes, the patience to teach somebody else that, because these are the tools by which we do our organizing, by which we get our radio show out, by which we keep in touch with each other for internal union matters, et cetera, et cetera. You have to be proactive to make sure that everyone else is on the page and make it as approachable as possible to everyone. Yes, fellow worker?
I've found that people in left spaces or even left political formations have a tendency to use that old a dictum of the, I believe it was SNCC, which said, each one, teach one.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee with Ella Baker and with Rapp and with, you know, some really strong leaders back in the day in the 60s. So what that meant is, and we also have a tradition, especially in the IWW, of what we call Skillshare, which is something that, you know, I've met a lot of younger people who really don't know one end of a hammer from the other. And it's not because of it's their fault. It's because they didn't have any use, you know, for that kind of tooling. And by the same token, they should realize that I have some skills that they don't, and I can share them very gently. Just teach me how to, you know, open my cell phone and everything like that. Go ahead.
Yeah, and please teach me how to change a tire. Yeah. I'm almost 27 and I still don't know what part of the car I'm supposed to put the jack under. I know an older fellow worker can help me with that.
We should have it.
It'll cost you.
We should probably make sure that everyone is on the same page with how you communicate, how you collaborate. You know, does everyone have access to the same Google Documents folders so that they have access
exactly.
to all the documents they
yeah.
need? Does everyone know how to use Discord if they want to use that as kind of a way to keep in touch with other fellow workers in the branch? You know, like you were saying, do a Skillshare or something like, not like Skillshare like the website, but do a Skillshare where everyone can sit down and say, okay, what is everybody having a hard time accessing or trying to use for the purposes of union-related work, and actually give those skills to people? I completely agree with you.
That's something for the Solidarity subgroup to set up. Wouldn't that be great?
Yes.
I would attend that.
Yeah, and you can almost think it's similar to like a tool library or like a labor library.
Exactly.
You can actually sit down and be like, okay, this is how it, you know, Instagram works. This is how Zoom or Jitsi works. This is what Discord is for.
I am getting excited. I'm jazzed.
Yeah. You could probably make it even broader outside of the Hilltop Solidarity spot, which is where we do our branch meetings, and probably make it like a community-related
event.
Oh,
my God. We probably need several sites, because if you're going to learn how to change a tire, that's a little different set of tools. But
there's not that many tabs or applications related to changing a tire. But hopefully all the tools will be immediately available to you and kind of obvious.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's a starting point.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is the kind of cross-generational collaboration which we're really trying to touch on in this discussion, mm-hmm. which is that the younger folks are more technologically adapted because of the fact that they grew up in the internet age. You know, I remember growing up in a house that always had a computer. We were one of the first families on our block that had a smartphone or something like that. And we definitely have a better ability, because of our experience, mm-hmm. to teach older generations how to use things like technology. Or in my previous conversation about language, what is the language commonly used for certain groups, organizations, yeah. minorities, etc. Pass it up.
I actually feel like this is a helpful conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to the next one. Do we have time?
Oh, we have plenty of time. We're currently at 57 minutes.
So the next roundtable discussion.
This kind of ties into what we were just talking
about. It does. It segues in. The issue of Israel-Palestine has brought a lot of things to the forefront of conversation, for better or for worse, and I think it's for better. We hear people being accused and groups being accused of anti-Semitism
right.
when what they are expressing is moral outrage and grief
mm-hmm.
over what the state of Israel is doing to the West Bank and to Gaza. And they're being called anti-Semites when actually what they are is anti-state Zionist. Of Israel policy and anti-U.S. Yeah. foreign policy, which is sending our, by way of our tax money, to Israel to be used against the Palestinians. You can't, on one hand, Biden, say, okay, we're going to do a food drop and then send bombs. I'm sorry, that doesn't work. That's my opinion.
They don't cancel out, is
yeah,
what you're saying.
Yeah, they don't. So what this brings up is what is going on with groups that label as anti-Semitic people who are upset about the U.S. position and Israel's position in regard to Gaza. And I wanted to open the conversation up around the table to intergenerational trauma, miseducation, and cynical misuse
mm-hmm.
of stereotypes.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Just to kind of throw out the first comment here really quickly, I think that it's interesting that in this whole, since October 7th, and arguably well before October 7th of last year, the concept of intergenerational trauma has not been thoroughly addressed, especially by mainstream media outlets, when we talk about the quote-unquote Israel-Palestine conflict. I think that for a lot of people who are very pro-Zionist in this country, who are very pro-Israel, they have grown up in an environment or a culture where the immediate prehistory of the Holocaust, the pogroms, things like that, and real state-coordinated anti-Semitic violence, which existed before the foundation of Israel, kind of led them to the belief that by forming their own state, a very heavily militarized and well-funded state, they can prevent themselves from anti-Semitic attacks or violence in the future. And, you know, how that idea is very much tied into mainstream Zionism, I feel like, is very apparent. Whereas the intergenerational trauma of a lot of the Palestinian experience is also in its own way it kind of has had the same effect, in the sense that there has been generations of Palestinians who have been kicked out of their homes, who have been deprived necessary resources. And their lives, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, over the past several decades who have suffered because of Israeli policies, specifically in the West Bank and in Gaza. So there is kind of these two separate cycles of intergenerational trauma which clash against each other again and again and again and again, but nobody ever says that phrase specifically. And I just find that to be a very interesting observation, because it is intergenerational trauma on the geopolitical scale
yep.
that we're dealing with here.
And to remark, I grew up in my childhood, I grew up in Brooklyn in New York, and I grew up in three different neighborhoods that were like three different planets. But one of the neighborhoods I lived in was Borough Park. And for any ex-New Yorkers that are out there, you'll know that Borough Park is principally an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. Or at least it was when I was there. I don't know about now. And I actually saw people with the numbers tattooed on their arms. They were Holocaust survivors. And that was some serious business, because any child of a Holocaust survivor can tell you that certain things were drilled into their heads. And that's direct intergenerational warpage, I guess you could call it. Now, it's good to teach your children the lessons of the past, and the most horrendous of all lessons was the Holocaust. Nobody is denying that, not at this table anyway, but to use the same exact methods that were employed to keep the Jewish population imprisoned and starving in the Warsaw Ghetto are being carried out in the name of the Jewish people, which is, that's what a lot of people are objecting to. The same policies are being carried out in the Gaza Strip. It's an open-air ghetto, and they have been bombing it, and they have been telling people, move over there, and then they bomb that area, and then move over here, and they bomb that. You know, that's kind of crazy, and that's not self-defense. So my point about growing up in that particular neighborhood at that particular time is that many of the children and grandchildren of those survivors of the horrendous European Holocaust are now currently in the most extreme right political formations in Israel and in the United States. And I remember these guys, and they were just as terrible as any Southern racist. They really were. And I suffered because I was from a half-and-half family, and I wasn't going to temple on Saturday. So I got yelled at and chased and sometimes beaten up by Jewish kids. So go figure that, you know. And what I'm saying is that what happened 80 years ago in Europe is now has been weaponized as a shield against any criticism whatsoever of Zionist organizations, because they're equating Zionism with Judaism, and that's simply not the case. There are Jews from all over the world, African Jews, Ethiopian Jews, Portuguese and Spanish Jews. And so to lump everybody under the Jewish faith as a Zionist is an error and should be corrected equally as much as anybody who claims to be fighting for Palestinian rights is called a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's just simply wrong. They're not. These are human beings. They have families, they have children who want to grow up, and so imagine the trauma on the youth of Palestine today, and what are they going to teach their children? What are they going to teach their children's children? And it doesn't look pretty. So the thing is to try to break that mold by looking into yourself and saying, I'm not going to act this way just because my parents acted that way. And if you can look at people as human beings with the same problems, same desires as anybody else on the planet, then that's a good step forward to eliminating behavior like that, but it's pretty broken now.
I was just wondering, out of curiosity, for a frame of reference, what years were those, let's say 5 years of the time when you were living there?
The late 50s, late 1950s.
I think it's also interesting that intergenerational trauma also isn't applied towards the analysis of terrorist organizations, which mm-hmm. is what a lot of this current conversation is about, because Hamas attacked Israel and mm-hmm. killed a bunch of Israeli civilians, which kind of kicked off this whole thing. And they have existed for a long time as an organization. And for some reason, especially a lot of these Zionist organizations, but also U.S. international policy as well, doesn't really seem to want to recognize the fact that intergenerational trauma is a great way to form a terrorist organization.
Yeah, that's the best way.
I mean, an organization like Hamas exists because an entire group of millions of people have been forced under such crappy conditions that they're willing to go to further extreme lengths. And finally, here's this organization that's willing to empower violence against Israelis and violence against Jewish people, which they do explicitly support, Hamas, I mean. And that organization exists because of that intergenerational trauma. And finally, here comes this organization coming along saying, well, we can fight back against these people. We can kick these people out of the Holy Land and create a state under our label, and only we can do that. The irony, of course, with Hamas being that Benjamin Netanyahu openly admitted to materially funding and financially aiding Hamas to come to power in the Gaza Strip in the first place, because they didn't want a united Palestinian front in both the West Bank and Gaza.
They didn't like the PLO.
Because it would be against Israeli interests in the region. Again, with the analysis of terrorist organizations, intergenerational trauma is a great way to do that. And Hamas as an organization has always banked on that. And so again, it's these two cycles of intergenerational violence that constantly clash against each other. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
To me, it seems that there's very little press coverage, even among the progressive press, of the Palestinian struggles, mm-hmm. the famine. I just don't see much.
There isn't much.
I mean,
it's because they keep shooting the reporters. That's why.
Yeah, no.
They do.
I know.
We got get reporters.
I know that.
And who kills them?
Over 100. Yeah. But there's some. And just it doesn't seem like, well, even if outside of the battle areas, just doesn't seem like there's much attention, really, to the millions that are starving.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH.
I'd like to bring another parallel to bear, something that might be difficult to swallow, which is that when you look at people in the Middle East, you know, you're seeing women in, devout costume, or just everyday women just wearing a headscarf, and therefore that can make them look alien, other, right? And there's been a long simmering anti-Semitism in the United States, specifically among the people who are waving the flag now, the worst, you know, against anti-Semitism, right? Supposedly. But what I'm getting at is that to bring it home more personally, look at the troubles in Northern Ireland.
I was going to bring that up.
There you go.
And Poland.
Yes, and Poland.
And, my God, Cambodia. Yes. All over the world.
That's right. And it goes on because, you know, I've seen some television shows about Northern Ireland and how, you know, after the agreement, everything's hunky-dory.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't. There's the old guys down in the various bars that are surrounded with sandbags and stuff who still feel the same way, both on the Republican side and on the Ulster side. Mm-hmm. So what I'm getting at is that their kids are learning to deal with each other on a different basis because they're not listening to their old men.
Thank God.
And their old woman. They're listening to each other. And that's what has to happen. And that will mitigate some of this intergenerational trauma. But it has to be addressed square on. And that's going to be real hard to do in Palestine.
Mm-hmm. In Israel, the state of Israel, when they're educating children in the schools, they never acknowledge that Palestine is a country. They never do. So the miseducation and the grooming for Zionists is right from the get-go. And even in our country, in the United States, we have a lot of people who are Jewish that were raised in Jewish parochial schools.
Shul.
That go and sign up in the military.
Yes.
In Israel.
I went to high school with a couple of guys like that.
And that's another example of miseducation.
Mm-hmm.
That to be a Jew, you have to be a Zionist, which is what you were bringing up.
Right. And it's difficult to separate because of the racism and anti-Semitism of the United States and Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted nothing more than to get rid of the Jewish population. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be wonderful if they all got on a boat and went somewhere?
To Uganda.
Uganda, right.
Yeah.
That was the first proposal.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
There were like 13 other proposals as well at the turn of the century by, I think it was like the Zionist Congress or something like that.
Herschel.
Yeah. Herschel, yeah.
Well, what I'm getting at is that the backlash that you're seeing is a direct result of poor policy on the United States and Europe's side. And nobody here, except a few stalwarts down south, I would think, but nobody here wants to be accused of being anti-Semitic.
I think especially on the note of global geopolitics as well, you know, speaking of foreign policy that directly benefits the Israeli military, specifically from both the United States and Europe, there was this, just to quote Joe Biden, ironically enough, from the early 90s, if Israel didn't exist, we would have to invent one.
Mm-hmm.
They are our quote-unquote only ally in the region. Which isn't true. We do have other geopolitical allies in the Middle East that we directly fund as well, Saudi Arabia being a big one of them.
But we said it's democracy, only democracy.
Yeah, it's the only democracy in the Middle East that we have a direct and strong relationship with, which, given how internal Israeli politics are going right now, I highly doubt. There is a very right-wing faction that is currently in control of the government right now.
Not very democratic.
No, not at all. Even Israelis are protesting the Israeli government, begging them to negotiate with Hamas to get the what's left of the hostages back, because Israel has not really been very keen to get them back for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
But the important point is that when we talk about this intergenerational, okay, we started off with activism mm-hmm. and avoiding ageism, and that kind of does blend into
it does.
Intergenerational trauma in a way, because when I was coming up as a teenager, I was taught to revere and to honor, okay, the old, I went to a May Day parade in New York, I think I've told you guys, and saw the Abraham Lincoln Brigade mm-hmm. veterans marching. So this is in like 1968. So very few of them left. And I was taught to take my hat off to those guys and give them the power salute mm-hmm. because they fought fascism when nobody else was. And so each generation has an ability to give direct life experience to the next generation and the next generation after that. That's the key, I think. And how to do that is the real sticking point. How to get young people, you know, go, listen to me, I was there, you know, 1968, which I was.
And but sometimes the older generation got it wrong.
Yes, indeedy.
And, mm-hmm. you know, blind respect toward the older generation, no matter what, is just as destructive as ignoring them.
Yeah. In other words, it feels patronizing. It feels as if, yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you for your contribution. Now, go have a cup of tea and sit down.
Well, no, believing every stupid thing the older generation said is wrong.
But we're not the stupid older generation. We're the cool older generation.
I mean, I guess just to kind of add my final comment to this conversation, even since I was a little kid, I've always appreciated the kinds of family and the friends and the community that I was around that was cognizant of the fact that the younger generation should do better than the older, mm-hmm. whether that's materially, whether that's, you know, in terms of their ethics and values and beliefs. And I think that it is very heartwarming to me that there's now this younger generation of, at least from what I've seen from all these campus protests and whatnot, that there is a younger generation of Jewish people and also an older generation of Jewish people as well who grew up in a very Zionist-related environment who are kind of coming out and saying, well, no, this has failed. This was kind of set up to fail pretty badly for the Palestinians especially, and we do need to do something about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I recognized, you know, I was raised in a Jewish household, conservative Judaism. Jewish household, but I can recognize Stockholm syndrome when I see it. And, you know, yeah, it was, the Holocaust was horrible. Why would we want to use those tactics on another population? That's what have we like become? Have we become the monsters that we escaped?
Projection.
And Jewish Voice for Peace, listener, is doing some very good work.
Yep.
Continue to speak out.
As well as the campus protests that are going on right now in the country as well. There's over 100 current campus protests and growing at all these different colleges and universities here in the United States and abroad as well. I know there's probably a couple hundred more just outside of the United States.
If you're in the Tacoma region, there's protests and encampments at University of Puget Sound here in Tacoma, University of Washington.
At Evergreen College as well?
Well, not the one in Tacoma.
Right, the one in Olympia.
The one in Olympia. There should be one in Tacoma, but their campus is so small it'd be hard to do an encampment. Yes, Gordon.
I'd like to ask you, fellow worker Marilyn, as a former mental health care worker mm-hmm. and a person with a lot of experience in dealing with traumatized people, mm-hmm. what would you think could be done, for instance, because it's so recent, to that young generation in Palestine who are witnessing all this stuff going on?
Oh, my God, Gordon. It is so enormous, and it's so tragic.
Yeah.
And when I think of it, I get so overwhelmed.
I understand.
Because a whole generation
yep.
has been so traumatized.
Where do we start? Look at the experience of African Americans in the United States. There was a couple of decades where they were experiencing complete impunity of white people who were lynching them.
This is almost worse because you have
children
that survived the injuries.
Yep.
But all of the members of their family were killed.
Yeah.
You have generations of damaged orphans and damaged children.
Right. So that's kind of what I'm after. What's it going to take?
I don't have the answer for you because it's very overwhelming. I know the help has to be becoming in the way it has to be other Palestinians that are going to be speaking to these children and working with these children.
Yeah.
You can't have an Israeli. You can't have an American. You can't have anybody that comes from those backgrounds.
Right.
Yes, Lynn.
I saw a film, a musician, and I don't remember his name, but he's popular here, kind of an easygoing, happy singer. And he went to countries where they were war-torn, and there were many women that were victims of rape, and they were just really withdrawn, and they couldn't talk even to each other. And he did music, and he got them all involved in music, and it just, like, melted their hearts and gave them hope, and it was just stunning.
Yeah, music is a language that everybody understands, and that would certainly be helpful. I'm so overwhelmed, Gordon, when I look at the level of trauma that's been visited on those children. Another generation growing up that's filled with anger and hatred and fear toward the other.
That are also potentially liable to be recruited by organizations like Hamas because of that traumatization.
Yes.
I mean, I believe that a recent survey of the Gaza Strip specifically said that more than half of the people there are under the age of 18.
That's right.
And like you said, there really isn't a whole lot of adults left to do that kind of mental health-related work or addressing the collective trauma of generations and generations of people that have been kicked out of their native lands that they lived on.
We're creating a generation of people that are potential terrorists.
Yes.
Exactly.
And
or at the very least, an entire population of people that is going to be incredibly impoverished for the next several decades.
And not necessarily fans of the USA and the UK, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Right. Speaking of
But I want to broaden it back out again, too.
Okay.
You know, when you mentioned Ireland, when you mentioned Poland.
Yeah.
Estonia, Lithuania.
Sudan.
All of those countries. We need to also, yes, our attention is on Israel-Palestine right now. But the listener to this program should understand the IWW position about war in general. And we got in big trouble in World War I because we were anti-recruitment and anti-war. We know that people who are recruited into the armed services are workers too.
Yep.
And they are the ones that are sent and get hurt and killed and injure others, and war is not the answer. War is a rich man's game.
The IWW even had a slogan back in World War I. They said, a bayonet is a weapon with a worker at both ends.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Does anybody want to say anything about that?
I mean, also coming from the IWW position as well, especially within the context of Israel-Palestine, like you said, this war is also being heavily financed by weapons manufacturers, by aerospace manufacturers.
Oh, yeah.
By a large variety of very large of corporations that are financially benefiting out of what the International Criminal Justice Courts are very blatantly considering to be a genocide.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of the activism that has specifically targeted those corporations that have asked them to divest at the very
least, for instance,
I think that a lot of the activism that has been directed towards those corporations and organizations that have been materially and financially benefiting out of this conflict, I think has definitely been a step in the right direction. That's not me slandering the campus protests. I'm not, like any good improv comedian, I'm not saying no, I'm saying yes and. Direct action is one way to bring a solution to the situation. I think that the campus protests are also doing a great job in terms of encouraging universities and other educational organizations to divest specifically from Israeli assets, especially in the aerospace and weapons manufacturing aspects as well.
And the surveillance.
And the surveillance as well. Good God.
Yeah.
Is there a lot of surveillance-related technology that is being sold to Israel for keeping Palestinians in line?
And that they're selling to the United States and other countries.
Mm-hmm.
There are no, you know,
coming to a workforce near you.
Yes. And just to dispel any notion that Israel is some kind of desperately poor country and the poor people there, you know, are suffering. No, they have an extremely strong tech and aerospace base. They make their own stuff. And that's what always That's what's been bothering me. Why do we have to send them $30 billion when they can make their own monstrous weapons?
Because they keep blowing theirs up.
That's right. They keep running out.
So good for the environment, don't you think?
Because the folks at home here are making a profit.
Yes, they are.
Exactly.
Also, if you just went out in the street and did a, you know, man on the street, woman on the street type interview, people are so miseducated about the situation. Say, we support Israel, of course. Why? Well, we've always supported Israel.
Because they're the homeland of the Jewish people, because it's a state that's necessary to protect Jewish populations from anti-Semitism, etc.
That's what they say, yeah.
Yeah.
But it hasn't always been thus, and, you know, it could be different, but it's going to take a tremendous amount. The whole system has to be changed, and that's what we're all about here, fellow workers.
So coming to the end of this conversation today, we would like to invite our fellow listeners to get out and get active on a variety of different causes, whether that's for labor, whether that's for Palestine, whether that's for social justice, for the environment. Mutual aid, absolutely. I actually do have an announcement of a local event that is specifically IWW. The Seattle branch of the IWW just recently sent us an invitation for...
Organizer Training 101.
Thank you. The Rain City Wobblies, that is the Seattle branch of the IWW, is doing an organizer training, also known as OT101. The way that this works is that if you're in the union, if you're interested in joining the union and you want to sign up, either I or Marilyn can help you sign up here in the Tacoma branch area, or in the Pierce County area specifically. If you want to learn how to organize your workplace and form a union, we have an organizer training class. To kind of give some context on this, the IWW very much believes that the worker is the organizer. You understand your workplace better than any paid organizer probably could, so we believe that you should lead the organizing yourself, and we will teach you the tactics, the tips, the tricks on how to do that in order for you to get a successful union at your workplace. So this organizer training, this OT101, which is being hosted by the Seattle branch, is going to be taking place on May 11th through 12th. The training will be 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. both days. It's going to be in person in Seattle. If you are interested and you want to reach out to us, whether that's on our official Facebook page or the WOB Radio Facebook page, we can send you a link to sign up to that. We highly encourage anyone who's interested in forming a union, especially with the IWW, to attend this class. I've personally been to one, and it is very informative. And a lot of the organizers that we have that teach these classes do a very good job at teaching you how to get a union in your workplace. That is one event. The other one that I would like to announce really briefly, unfortunately this episode is not going to get out in time. But we'll announce it anyway.
Well, I want to do a shout out to the Labor Education School.
The Tacoma Labor School.
Tacoma Labor School for hosting on May Day at the Grand a showing and then discussion afterwards of Sorry to Bother You. It was well attended, and it was very good to see that film again.
It's also funny.
Yeah, it's funny, but it's serious too.
Yeah.
There really is no limit to what capitalists will do to ensure a workforce that's as inexpensive and as frightened and in debt as possible.
Expendable.
Yeah.
I'd also like to give another shout out here in the Tacoma area. Macy's Workers for Power, which is part of UFCW 367 here in the Tacoma area, is currently organizing at the Macy's at the Tacoma Mall. They are currently fighting for contract negotiations currently with their managers and employers, and they are desperately looking for people to come out to pickets, to leaflet, to flyer, whatever, so that those workers can get a good contract and put the pressure on the corporate executives.
Just to make note, if you're going to go and support that picket or any other picket, it's a great idea, if you're not a member of their union, to go find who the picket captain is, and they'll be the guys and gals with the bullhorns, and ask them, say, I would like to walk the picket line in support of your union. You can give them a little bio if you want, but ask permission, because the whole country's having problems with counter demonstrators and people being mistaken for allies and things like that. So just ask the picket captain.
I think we should be clear about the Macy's issue. I believe they are unionized. What they're doing is they're negotiating a new contract.
Yes, I was going to make that correction too. They're currently bargaining for a new contract for better pay, better health care programs specifically for their workers.
And so this is the Macy's at the mall.
This is the Macy's at the Tacoma Mall, yes.
Okay.
Definitely want to give them a big shout out. Also, another shout out to the International Longshoremen's Union, Local 23. I know that we've kind of shouted them out in the last episode, but again, congratulations for your recent win at Wallenius Wilhelmsen. They just recently won a union down there in the Port of Tacoma, and so I'm hoping to arrange an interview with them soon to get them on the air.
That'd be great.
Also, just as kind of a brief aside, we are hoping to put out more standalone interviews for WAB Radio. I've already done 3 over the past month and a half with various different community and labor organizers. And so if anyone in this region is interested in getting their message on the air, you can feel free to reach out to WAB Radio at our Facebook page or at our newly formed email. That's WAB_radio@proton.me. You can reach out to us with any news suggestions, discussion suggestions. If there's an organizing campaign going on in your area and you'd like to get on the radio, you can feel free to reach out to us and we can set up an interview for you and help get your message out there. Once again, fellow listeners, this has been a production of WAB Radio. We are all fellow workers of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. We want to thank you so much for tuning in to listen to a radio show that's union-made and union-focused. Once again, if you'd like to reach out to us, you can reach out to the WAB Radio Facebook page or our previously stated email. We'd like to also give a big thank you to 101.9 KTAH, 95.3 KTQA, and 94.9 KZAX up in Bellingham. We wish you all the best in all of your future organizing efforts and solidarity.
Solidarity.